welcome to the Davos Man episode of Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck, also of Axios.
Hello, hello.
I've been loving your newsletter. You are now actually putting out a newsletter every morning, and it's amazing. What's the name of the newsletter?
Axios Markets, please subscribe. It's me and co-writer Matt Phillips, who is delightful, and sometimes Neil Irwin writes for us. It's like, it's really good, and it's free.
So Matt Phillips and Neil Irwin are... they used to work for a terrible place called the New York Times, but now they work for this wonderful place called Axios. The New York Times is basically, it has one reporter left at this point. Mr. Peter Goodman, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be the last person with the lights on at the sad New York Times.
So, Peter, introduce yourself. Who are you and what brings you onto this show?
I'm the global economics correspondent. I'm based in New York, and I've written a book called Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World.
So if you live in the world, you should listen to this, this issue. You will discover how you have been devoured.
Actually, even if you live in other worlds, because, you know, Bezos is going to space now.
Exactly. We are all like Jonah. We are in the belly of the billionaire, and we don't even realize it. We are going to talk about Larry Fink, who's one of the classic Davos men, and his business model over at BlackRock. We are going to talk a bit about some of the other billionaires. We are also going to talk about Satya Nadella. I'm not sure whether he's a billionaire or not, but he's the CEO of Microsoft. He's very much a Davos man, and he just announced that he was buying Activision Blizzard for $69 billion. We're going to talk about that deal. We are going to talk about the fiasco that is the whole 5G rollout, because it's hilarious. We're going to have a Slate Plus segment on Peloton, because that's kind of funny too. It's all coming up on Slate Money. So let's jump into this. This week is the week of the great Davos show. I have recorded Slate Money from Davos on multiple occasions. It is always, I believe the technical term is, a clusterfuck. It involves handing over envelopes of cash to random functionaries of Eurovision at the bottom of the hill and trying to get them to hand over what passes for a recording studio, even though there's no soundproofing at all. I feel like the new way of recording Davos shows, which is where everyone is just sitting around at home drinking cups of tea, is much more copacetic, especially when there's no actual Davos because it was canceled. I mean, this is the best possible Davos, right, Peter?
Well, the fact that we don't have to put crampons on our boots and go through security 17 times a day as if we're, you know, simulating going through LaGuardia Airport 17 times in 24 hours, that is certainly very pleasing. The food is much better at home. The lack of, as Kara Swisher put it to me the other day, rich people walking around licking other rich people. Yes, it's much, much nicer to contemplate the snow here at home.
And so now it's going to be, it is going to happen apparently in May, but the whole business calendar, it's got this sort of January focus. So you get things like the Oxfam Inequality Report, which always comes out the week of Davos, and you get things like the Larry Fink annual letter, which always comes out the week of Davos, and you have things like the Edelman Trust Barometer, which always comes out the week of Davos. And even when Davos is canceled, all of these things still come out as scheduled. And I really wanted to talk to you about the Larry Fink letter, because Larry Fink is one of the main characters in your book, and he doesn't come out particularly glowing and covered in halos and light in your book. So explain who he is and what the problem is with him.
Sure. So Larry Fink is the world's largest asset manager. He has vacuumed up pension funds from around the world, university endowments. He's managing more than $10 trillion. You heard that right, $10 trillion. And that gives him almost godlike powers of observation over the movements of money. He's a genius by all accounts. I mean, he's worked essentially as the advisor to Uncle Sam, not just after the 2008 financial crisis, but now during the crisis in the first wave of the pandemic. I mean, people trust his counsel because he actually knows what's going on. And he built out a surveillance system called Aladdin that's his attempt to keep tabs on, you know, unexpected changes in markets, increased borrowing costs, potential crises before they happen. And people pay good money for that. I mean, he's now selling Aladdin to other financial institutions that collectively manage more than $20 trillion. So this is somebody who, you know, has a great deal to say about markets. And that's why everybody takes seriously this annual letter to shareholders. But he's positioned himself as the hero of this thing called stakeholder capitalism, this idea that, as its champions would tell you, Milton Friedmanism is dead. It's no longer just about corporate executives being as greedy as possible, maximizing returns, and through that, the magic of the markets will supposedly trickle down to the rest of us, something that has in real life happened zero times. But we're done with that conversation. The new conversation is about catering to stakeholders, the environment, labor, local communities. And so in Larry's most recent letter, he doubles down on stakeholder capitalism because he's getting attacked by the right. You know, the state of Texas has just reacted to his latest talk about climate change and the potential for pulling funds out of companies that don't move fast enough to address climate change. So he's doubled down and said, look, you know, this is not woke. This is real capitalism, but it's about getting ahead of the curve in terms of what we as corporate managers need to do.
So he's saying something which seems uncontroversial, which is that, like, if you don't position yourself as a company to be well positioned in a world of climate change, then that's a sort of existential risk for your company, and I don't necessarily want to be invested in that.
Look, Davos Man's great at words, and Larry Fink's great at words. And I mean, there's no question it makes all the sense in the world that if you're going to invest in the mortgage-backed securities market, and Larry Fink actually pioneered the mortgage-backed security back when he was at First Boston, then yeah, you want to know, like, is a flood going to come that's not built into everybody's models that's going to wipe out the value of real estate pledged as collateral? That's all great. You know, he talks about the need to, in this most recent letter, to, you know, respond to the fact that work has changed during the pandemic, employers have to deal with different expectations from employees. All this stuff's perfectly sensible, but think about the stakeholders that are perpetually missing from this. There's a lot of talk of employees. There's no talk of labor unions. There's actually this incredible talk. I fished out this one quote about government. We need governments to provide clear pathways and a consistent taxonomy for sustainability policy, regulation, and disclosure across markets. Yeah, you know, who could argue with that? Of course we do. Well, you know, left unsaid is that BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, belongs to the Business Roundtable. The Business Roundtable has lobbied aggressively against regulations, helped deliver Trump's package of tax cuts worth $1.5 trillion, lavished on people like Larry Fink. You know, that diminishes the ability of government to do what it needs to do, including collect taxes, including regulate effectively. He's part of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he has departed, you know, very clearly from his own stated principles, especially on the environment.
So basically your problem with Larry Fink is a kind of that there might be a hypocrisy there, that like he might be saying a certain number of words and the words might all be well and good, but that, like, you know, he's also a rapacious capitalist and we can't trust him to save the world.
The world has rapacious capitalists, right? That's fine. That's why we need regulators. It's worse than that. He's actually, like other Davos men, like Mark Benioff, who said at Davos last year that CEOs are the real heroes of the pandemic. They're positioning themselves as the saviors. They're essentially saying, hey, we've got this. We don't need labor unions. We don't need regulations. We don't need taxes. That's just money squandered on bureaucrats who aren't helping us. We can take care of life's problems. And so it's not merely hypocrisy. Look, everyone's a hypocrite if you really look at people's records carefully. It's that he is essentially propagating this idea that government doesn't need to do its job. While meanwhile, you know, BlackRock is one of the largest investors in JBS, the world's largest meat packer, which is clear-cutting the Amazon to expand beef production.
Okay, so I want to, like, address that, because this is one of this is my thing about Larry Fink is that there seems to be two general views of Larry Fink. One is that he is, like the Davos view, which is that he's this far-sighted man who controls $10 trillion and is terribly important and can help, you know, what's the word, improve the state of the world, to use the slogan of Davos. And then the other one is that he's actually making it harder to improve the state of the world because of everything you're saying, that he's making it harder for governments to regulate, and he's part of this kind of laissez-faire subtext to Davos, which has proved extremely harmful. And my view of Larry Fink is actually neither of those, which is that roughly 75% of the money that he manages, he has no ability to actually choose where it's invested in at all. It's all passive. It's ETFs and index funds and iShares and that kind of stuff.
I just cut you off because I saw you tweeting about that. And like, just to emphasize, 25% of $10 trillion is an awful lot of money regardless.
It's $2.5 trillion. It's like, you know, it's smaller than PIMCO, you know, it's...
And we do know that companies make moves based on what this man says. Like, he wants people to...
We do? I don't think we do.
There's like there's an academic paper I can put in the show notes that shows like when he says disclose climate risks in your filings, companies actually just start doing stuff. Like academics have tracked it. I don't know if this is effective to disclose the risks, but
like just to finish, just to finish my thought here, like one of the super interesting things about the Larry Fink letter this year is that he ends it by saying, what I really want to do is empower the owners of the capital. So the $10 trillion that he controls, yeah, he has a certain amount of control over it. Although, as I say, for 75% of it, really not that much. People want to invest in the S&P 500. They give it to him to invest in the S&P 500. He doesn't have any discretion about that. And what he's saying is that for ultimately all of those investors, he doesn't even want to vote those shares. He wants those beneficiaries, the actual beneficial owners of the capital, to decide how they want to vote in, you know, proxy votes and that kind of thing. And really, voting is the one place where he has power. The one place where he has power is to say, I have $10 trillion, and so I can, if I don't like you, I can vote against you. And it's true that he hasn't used it, which is one, you know, extra mark in the column of, like, he's actually pretty otiose. But even like if he kind of keeps that bazooka in his back pocket kind of thing and kind of walks into a CEO's office and says, I'd like you to disclose more climate, you know, the CEO knows that, as you say, like he owns 7-8% of more or less any company that you want to mention. And so he's a major shareholder. He's a long-term shareholder. He's the kind of shareholder that you want to keep happy. And so you do these things to keep those big shareholders happy. But if he gives up even having the ability to control how those shares are voted, he just becomes like a super thin intermediary with no control over where the money is invested.
I think you're missing a couple of big things. First of all, he's given cover to people like the Saudi monarchy. I mean, he's a huge investor in Aramco. He's helping gather capital for pipelines that Aramco's building. He shows up at Davos in the desert, right? I mean, this event not long after the Khashoggi murder. I mean, this is a pretty nice laundering of image for people who need it, and a clear sign that, you know, it's not going to cost you any money that you murdered a Washington Post columnist. Moreover, he's the largest player in the International Institute of Finance, which is the lobby shop for every financial institution on earth, and plays a very strong role in policy on emerging market debt. Now, there is a massive debt crisis in the developing world, where you have countries in the middle of a pandemic, you know, Zambia, Ghana, Pakistan, that are actually cutting their spending on things like healthcare in the middle of a pandemic because they have to pay back people like Larry Fink. Larry Fink goes into Argentina and he actually heads the largest consortium of bondholders who are furious that they backed Macri. Larry Fink personally bought the Macri story that this was the end of populism in Argentina, that Argentina was going to become, you know, this normal, fiscally responsible company. And he was a leader in funneling, you know, $100 billion into Argentine bonds. And this is not the old days of, you know, the peso crisis in Mexico in the 80s where, you know, it's just a bunch of, it's Citibank and a bunch of other banks. They can get in a room. They can say, how big a haircut are we going to take to get this emergency behind us? Larry Fink has gotten, you know, school teachers' pensions in the north of England. He's gotten firefighters in Ohio, and their savings are now in Argentine debt. And he's going to have a hard time telling them that he's lost their money on emerging market debt. And he understands that Argentina is merely the first of many countries around the globe where debt has to be worked out. He personally turns the screws to the Argentine government to sweeten the deal by a couple pennies on the dollar at the same time that he's championing stakeholder capitalism. I mean, that is power that he uses at the same time that he will tell you, you know, if he's asked, well, how come you can't, if this stakeholder capitalism is real and you care about the S in ESG, why can't you cut a break to a country where poverty's soaring, where people are diving into dumpsters for their dinner? And, you know, he will say through the IIF, well, you know, fiduciary responsibility, what you're saying, oh, it's mostly passive money. It's not our money. We're just managing. So he talks every which way, depending upon the situation.
One thing I thought was interesting was the brilliance. I don't know about the brilliance of this man's investing acumen, and I don't really understand the Aladdin piece. Did he see the financial crisis coming? Like, I don't get that if his software was so good.
That's a very good question.
One thing, but the thing I wanted to note is just the brilliance of his rhetoric here, positioning himself as a woke capitalist and like purposely putting that line in the letter. It makes him seem like he's not what Peter is saying at all. And it makes like these Republicans in Congress crazy and makes them attack him as a liberal, essentially. So it's like a way he obscures what he's doing on like this like other level that's almost insane to contemplate. And I guess it's what kind of Davos does more broadly. It makes all these folks seem super liberal and left and socially conscious when they're doing the exact opposite. And all these people on the right just buy it and attack them. It's like it hurts my brain.
I think that's actually strengthening for Davos, man.
Are you saying that like it's good for Blackstone and Goldman Sachs and Credit Suisse and all of these big financial institutions to be attacked by the Republicans for being too woke because it makes the liberals think, well, they can't be that bad if they're being attacked by Republicans?
I think so, yeah. It obscures the relationship between Republicans and moneyed interests. And it also kind of aligns the money interests with the left and with liberals without liberals or the left having to think about the other stuff that Peter has written a book about. You know what I mean? It like screws up
the whole I buy system. That analysis because, I mean, my whole argument about stakeholder capitalism is it's a way of checking the box that we're taking care of the big issues of the day, like climate change, while in truth, Larry Fink is an enabler of the status quo, which is true of everyone at the World Economic Forum, you know, committed to improving the state of the world, connoting change. These are the biggest beneficiaries of the status quo. And in terms of how they spend their money on lobbying, where they deliver their capital, it's all about perpetuating the status quo and their own privileges. So yeah, it's great if the state of Texas is taking shots at Larry Fink and saying, don't threaten to divest from fossil fuel companies. Hey, look, you know, these people are mad at me, so I must be on the right side of climate change, while in fact I'm helping Saudi Aramco get more fossil fuels out of the ground and squeezing poor countries to pay pennies on the dollar.
Although I will say, apropos the Texas thing, that Fink has been pretty explicit about not threatening to divest. Like, divestment is not one of the tools that he's pointed to in his arsenal. He's always been, you know, on the side of like engagement, and we want to talk to management and get them to change the way they run the company. And what good would it do if we were to sell our shares to someone else? The company would still be doing what the company would be doing. And like, you can argue both sides of that one, but ultimately I think if you want to change a company, then having no shares in it is going to make it harder to change the company than if you do have shares in it, right?
Oh, I think that's a fair read. But, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to see what change actually occurs. And he has intimated in the past. I mean, now he goes out of his way to say, we're not talking about divestment. We need the intelligence that people running fossil fuel companies to, they're a part of the solution. In the past, in previous letters, he has intimated, you know, if you don't get right on climate change, the markets will deprive you of capital. And he has held out the possibility of shareholder votes that then environmentalists complain never actually happened.
No, it's just all talk. It didn't. I mean, it happened with Exxon. We have seen it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, in the last 18 months.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I want to talk about Microsoft. I really want to talk about this one because it's a great encapsulation of everything that we've been talking about. We have a scandal-ridden company with its share price in the toilet on the grounds of exactly what you're talking about, the social and governance failures. And I'm talking, of course, about Activision Blizzard, the video game developer. And what happens, but this big, boring megalith, Microsoft, comes along and announces that it's buying it for $69 billion. Emily, I know you have opinions on this one.
Okay, so this is a really, really big deal. Microsoft's biggest deal ever, and the biggest, I think, video game deal ever. Interesting, the two biggest video game deals ever occurred this month in January. So it's a very big deal. It means all kinds of things for video gaming. The only reason it's happening, the only reason Microsoft was able to buy Activision is because Activision's CEO founder, Bobby Kotick, behave so badly, which I think is weird that in July and then in the fall, there are all these allegations about Kotick as the CEO of Activision. He basically oversaw rampant sexual harassment. Women were underpaid, mistreated, propositioned by executives, all this bad stuff. There's rape allegation even. And allegedly Kotick knew about it all, never told the board. And when all this comes out, the stock price, like you said, just totally falls off the cliff. Everyone's very upset. And Microsoft, which had been trying to buy this company for a long time because it owns really popular games like Call of Duty and World of Warcraft, was now's our chance. And they go to Activision, which wants to make a change but doesn't want to get rid of Kotick because he's been there from the beginning. And they're this is our chance, to get out from under all this bad stuff. So now we have a deal. And I was just thinking this morning how everyone was upset about Me Too back in 2017. It was going to be so bad for executives and companies and all this. But really, it's all fine. Microsoft is going to do great here. Satya Nadella wants to become the Netflix of gaming. That's what's going to happen. He's going to benefit. Microsoft's going to benefit. Maybe there'll be some justice for the women who are harassed and the employees who work at Activision, who knows? Bobby Kotick is going to get paid $293 million. He's expected to leave the company once the deal closes in a year, but he's going to get a massive, massive golden parachute. And I don't actually think that they're going to be able to take any of that back or anything, although there's some, shareholders upset.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen like the, you know, the woke capitalists come out and say he shouldn't get this massive payout. But like, morally speaking, you're right. Legally speaking, like, you know, as you said, he basically has founder status in this company. He was the one who kind of bought it out of bankruptcy and built it up to what it is. He like owns equity in the company. And if someone is buying that equity the way that, you know, fungible equity works, is you wind up making a lot of money and you have a contract. Like, I would love it if there were a way to punish him financially for the, you know, lax oversight that he showed and for the failure to report to the board. But like, I haven't seen any particularly credible proposals of how the board might be able to do that, especially given that like he's the CEO and there's no way this deal goes through unless he like agrees to it.
Right. And I think the process of like trying to actually fire him for cause or something like that, like they would just get them thrown into court and it would be a whole mess, like the Les Moonves kind of experience at CBS. So better to just let him go with his $293 million. It's just, I mean, the company is already pushed out. I think the Wall Street Journal reported at least like 40 employees, right, have gone and been disciplined, but not the CEO. It's just, it kind of ties back to Peter's book, honestly. Bobby Kotick is not a Davos man, but like he's got Davos man power here.
Nadella is, and Nadella signed the Business Roundtable statement of a purpose of a corporation. Your Friedmanism is over. It's about stakeholders. Well, the fantastic thing about this, I mean, it's not fantastic. It's really kind of horrifying. The suffering of these women in this culture at Activision has effectively subsidized the shareholders of Satya Nadella's Microsoft, because the suffering comes to light, drives down the price of Activision. Microsoft sees a great way to fill up a hole in its portfolio and get into gaming, and they can buy this distressed asset at a cheap price because of these women who've suffered in this company. And the guy who's essentially responsible for the suffering, we know thanks to the Wall Street Journal, you know, knew well and good what was going on, but took no action, shoved it under the carpet because it didn't have anything to do with selling video games. He's now, as you correctly note, Emily, going to walk out the door with a very sweet deal. You know, everybody wins except for the people who already lost.
Is this a bad deal or a good deal? Like, it seems to me that, you know, Matt Levine put it quite well in his newsletter. Like, if Facebook had bought Activision, everyone would be like, oh my God, the evil Meta has gone and bought the evil Activision, and it's just going to be this axis of evil. Whereas if Microsoft buys Activision, like, you know, you've basically fall asleep before you reach the end of the first sentence. And Microsoft has this kind of deadening effect. And if anyone can sort of exorcise the ghosts of Bobby Kotick, it's probably Microsoft. They can just incorporate all of these different bits and pieces into the Microsoft Borg. And this will be good for the employees at Activision. It will be good for the Microsoft shareholders. It will be good for Activision shareholders. The one question I wanted to ask was like this idea about Microsoft sort of getting Activision, quote unquote, on the cheap because the share price has fallen after all of the revelations came out. That's the one thing I might push back a little bit about, that I think that we should take that fall in the share price seriously, that it's a creative company. The value of the company is in the creative output of its employees. These employees were obviously extremely badly treated, and it was obviously a much worse run company than anyone had dared to imagine. And I think that the revelations reduced the share price because it made the market realize that the company just really was a bad company and was not worth as much. I think that Microsoft is paying obviously a lot of money for this, but I don't think this idea that they're getting it cheap kind of implies that it had some kind of correct value before the revelations came out. And I don't think it did. I think it had an overinflated value before the revelations came out because the market didn't know how bad it was.
I think the point isn't that Microsoft's getting it cheap. It's more like Microsoft's getting it at all, because according to the reporting, Microsoft had been trying to buy Activision before the scandal dropped. And it was the scandal dropping and the stock price dropping that it made it possible. So it's not like Microsoft was like, now we can afford this company. It was more like, now the company will sell itself to us because they are desperate and struggling. You know what I mean? So it was the price that they were able to strike at. That's all.
If I may pull back very broadly, I mean, my book essentially argues that the billionaires are telling us that there are saviors and we can count on them to fix life's problems, contrary to the lived experience of those of us who are not billionaires. After the 2008 financial crisis, we have economies crumbling, people thrown out of jobs, people losing homes. We see no accountability for the financial players who are actually responsible for the shenanigans that tank the real economy. And we've seen again through the crisis of the pandemic, yet this time we actually had real rescues for real people, expanded unemployment benefits in the States. We had all of these furlough programs in Europe. That was all very helpful. But most of the money was spent bolstering assets. When you bolster assets, that helps people who own assets. People can see that with their own eyes. And now if you're going to zero in on Microsoft and Activision, you get a company that where a culture is horrible, is predatory for women who are leaving, who are actually going public with horrible things. And the people running the company are cashing out. The company that now owns it is cashing out. It's just another indicator, I think, for ordinary people that the people running our economies are thinking about other things than the real needs and any kind of accountability, the real needs of those of us who depend upon paychecks to pay our rent.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Talking of technology, Emily sent me about 8 emails. She's rolling her eyes. She's like, Felix, do we have to talk about this? And
Peter didn't want to either.
And Peter was like, this
are
is
we
boring.
Talking about crypto?
No, 5G. We're talking about
no
5G.
Oh, 5G. Oh, no, we can talk about 5G. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. I love this 5G story because it really, to me, is the epitome of the weakness of the Davos model. And just to rewind, the 5G story is that the US government sold off a bunch of 5G spectrum for $80-some billion. Anyway, it was a huge amount of money. And then there was another $13 billion got spent on building things out.
They could have just bought a video game company with
exactly. like with the amount of money that Verizon and AT&T spent on 5G licenses, they could have bought Activision Blizzard, and then they would have got even worse. But the instead they bought these 5G licenses, which gave them the right to use that spectrum. And this was years ago, and soon as this happened, everyone was like, okay, there's a problem here. Little bit of the electromagnetic spectrum that the 5G system uses is scarily close to the bit of the electromagnetic system that allows planes to land safely when it's foggy and there's bad visibility. We really don't want the 5G interfering with the radio altimeters. So we should do something about this. And so what they do is the classic Davos solution. What they do is they put together a multi-stakeholder committee of a whole bunch of aviation people and a whole bunch of telecoms people, and they go into the gnarliest, most awesome amounts of detail, and they create thousands of pages of technical specifications, and they're asking each other all of these incredibly detailed questions. The telecoms people are asking the aviation people, tell me exactly about how these altimeters work, and the aviation people are asking the telecoms people, like, tell me exactly how much power you're putting into these radio antennas. And and the whole idea is they can work out where there could be any problems and work out how they might be able to fix those problems. Except that didn't happen. After all of the paper flying back and forth, what happens is they wind up writing this letter to the U.S. government basically saying, yeah, there may or may not be a problem, but there's nothing we're going to do about it. And then nothing happened until suddenly, like, the, you know, Verizon and AT&T are going to switch on their 5G networks, and all of the airlines say, well, okay, you can switch on your 5G networks, but we're going to have to cancel 15,000 flights because we can't fly if your 5G networks are on. And suddenly, like, everyone's like, wait, really? And they're like, yeah, really? And you're like, it was such a fuck up. It was amazing.
But can we also explain why 5G matters? So as far as I can tell, it matters because it's going to power a lot of cool stuff, internet-y stuff that doesn't exist yet but might in the future, like maybe whatever Microsoft does with its video games needs 5G to actually happen, right?
It's all about low latency. You get to do things quickly. It will help self-driving cars. I'm a 5G bear. Like, I don't think that 5G is going to be nearly as transformative as the 5G bulls think it is going to be. But clearly, AT&T and Verizon have invested $80 billion in it, so they think it's going to be a big deal. Whether it matters or not, the fact is that the network is now something that exists. And it's something that may or may not exist within, like, 2 miles of flight paths coming into airports. And someone needs to fix this. And the someone who needs to fix this is obviously and clearly and undeniably the U.S. government, which controls the Federal Aviation Authority and the Federal Communications Commission. The FAA and FCC are both arms of the U.S. government, and they can work out what the safe and proper thing to do is. And there's no reason why that shouldn't happen, except that the FAA and the FCC seem to hate each other and just can't agree on this shit.
This, by the way, is fantastic for Davos Man, right? Davos Man wins when there's uncertainty, dysfunction, and confusion. I mean, one of the things that Benioff said last year at Davos, when he was saying that CEOs are the heroes of the pandemic, he said, and he was talking about, you know, vaccines and finance for staving off bankruptcy. And he said, listen, you know, the government didn't save you. NGOs didn't save you. We saved you. And he added, I thought this was really wonderful. He said, not for profit, but to save the world. Well, if we can see, to your point, Felix, that faced with the possibility that we're going to shut down air travel for huge numbers of people in some major air corridors, unless the federal government acts, and yet we immediately get into bureaucrats being bureaucrats and thinking about their turf. I don't know. This is reminiscent of, you know, something like 4,000 years ago when I was a telecom reporter in Washington, when we were still worrying about 3G, they auctioned off licenses for what was then known, if memory serves, as the Channel 60 to 69 spectrum. These were still over-the-air television channels, and the FCC was prepared to, actually raised a lot of money, licensing them off to all the big telecom providers. And there was some question about interference with home appliances and what would happen to other TV signals. But that all got swept under the rug because the telecoms were so important and all anybody cared about at that point was wireless internet. Whereas this is two things that people, you know, these are two high stakes areas. I mean, if you shut down flights, we're going to notice that immediately and it's going to be a problem. And the fact that the government can't fix that just underscores the point that the billionaires are already making. Just leave everything to us. That's how they get away with cutting taxes and constantly.
But the point is that the private sector multi-stakeholder convention between the CEOs trying to fix it completely failed. And the reason the government needs to come in and fix it is because the private sector and the CEOs didn't fix it. And, you know, the way it's ultimately going to wind up getting fixed is almost certainly that the telcos are just going to have to not have their 5G along flight paths for the next 5 years or so, while the FAA goes through the process of basically reconfiguring all of the radio altimeters in all of the airplanes so that they can work alongside 5G.
I'll bet you dinner that Microsoft gets a contract to solve this at some point. Cisco will get a piece of the action. Don't weep for the telcos or the people.
Now, you know who's going to make money from this is McKinsey.
Oh, every which way. Yeah, every which way.
Oh, McKinsey, I think, is making money from Peloton, which you said we could talk about in the Plus. So.
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about Peloton in the Plus. The amazing story of Peloton going up and down. That's coming up in Slate Plus. But before that, we have a numbers round to get through. Emily, do you have a number?
Yes, I have a number.
What's your number?
6.12 million. That is the number of existing homes that were sold in 2021, which is a lot of houses, the highest number in 15 years. So since you know, the bubble and everything, because housing is crazy right now. There aren't enough houses to go around for everyone who wants them. Mortgage rates are ticking up a little bit, but doesn't seem to stop what's going on, which is prices are going way up and supply is going way down. And at the same time, rents are going up. So it's sort of an interesting time for real estate.
Yeah, this is going to really show up in inflation figures over the next 6 months or so, because everyone looks at year-on-year inflation and we know what, you know, where the prices were in the first half of 2021, and we know how much they've come up. And that's just going to really, even if all of the used cars come down in price, which they probably won't, even if food and energy comes down in price, which it probably won't, like the housing alone is going to keep inflation figures well above that 2% target. So the transitory is going to be very transitory.
Yeah. And the whole market is super interesting because it's like, there's all this movement out of big metro areas messing up all these smaller housing markets where you used to be able to get affordable houses. But because like people like who lived in Brooklyn or Westchester are moving to these smaller markets, they're driving up prices there. So it's all like really weird and interesting. I don't know. Something to pay attention to.
There aren't that many cheap cities outside basically Texas anymore. I'm going to come up with my number, which is $330 billion. That is the final tally. That is how much money U.S. startups raised in 2021, which obliterates every previous record. It is literally double what we had in 2020, which was 167. It's a complete record. And it's not just the amount of money being raised that has hit like insane levels. The value of the exits of startups like getting acquired or going public was $774 billion, which is triple what we saw in 2020. The VC/startup world is en fuego right now, and no one knows where it might end. Aaron Griffith had a great piece in the New York Times about this, talking about this wonderful thing called the reverse pitch, where instead of companies going up to VCs and saying, we have a good company, can you please give us money? It's now the other way around, where VCs go up to companies and say, like, we have done a whole bunch of due diligence on you without you even asking you, and here's a 90-page proposal about why you should let us invest in your company.
That's amazing.
And that's how VC works now. That's how Tiger gets the deals. Peter, what's your number?
My number, somewhat related to Emily's number, $300 million. That's the amount of money that Steve Schwarzman's Blackstone has spent just in the last few weeks buying up affordable housing in South Florida. Now, Blackstone made a fortune after the foreclosure crisis. They bought up huge numbers of single-family homes in all the Sun Belt, hard-hit places. Blackstone a la Davos Man said this was just an act of civic virtue. You know, we took these homes with their overgrown lawns and rodent infestations and fixed them up and put families in them. You could almost hear the soundtrack, you know, for a life insurance commercial with the golden retriever puppy romping around on a lawn with a toddler. Of course, the reality was he launched Invitation Homes to run this portfolio, and a lot of reporting has shown that Invitation invited tenants to pay much higher rents while looking for customer service on websites that never got back to anybody, jacked up rents, and kicked a lot of people out when they couldn't pay. That's a template that Blackstone has applied in Europe and in other parts of the world. Well, now the new model is rent to own, where they give people these leases that are supposed to be getting them on the path to home ownership. And the early returns on that are that the terms are set such that it's really very difficult for most people to get anywhere close to home ownership, and people are giving up mid-stride. But Schwartzman is back in the game because he's got a nose for money.
I am a big fan of anyone who's turning owner-occupied housing into rental housing. I think we need a lot more rental housing, but we have had this conversation too many times on Slate Money, and we are not going to revisit that. I think that's it for the main show. Thanks, Peter, for coming on. It's been awesome having you.
Thank you for having me.
Do stick around for the Slate Plus on Peloton. Many thanks for all of you guys for listening and sending in your emails, slatemoney@slate.com. And many thanks especially to Shayna Roth, who's managed to put this show together amazingly as ever. We will be back next week with another episode of Slate Money.